From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. It's that time of year again. Ringing cash registers, wrapping papers, secret Santas and white elephants, gasps of delight, and awkward thank yous. It's the season of the gift. But how much is enough? And is it really better to give than to receive?
Gifts make slaves like whips make dogs.
We'll hear from an anthropologist with a new take on giving, and why only the super rich can save us. The practical utopian novel from none other than Ralph Nader.
I could tell Buffett, you want to have a comprehensive rehaul of the tax system, Warren? Split off $1 billion from the 32 you gave to the Gates Foundation, and I'll get it for you in 2 years.
Tracy Gehry was born into a fortune. Her mom was a Pillsbury. Her parents continued to make big money throughout their lives. But when Gehry got her inheritance, she decided to give it away. All of it. Now she's helping other people do the same. How common is major philanthropy among the so-called 1%?
I think it's much more common today than it was in the 50s and the 60s. My family had over $30 million in the 50s and 60s, and so they didn't hide their wealth at all. They really enjoyed it. But they were very attentive about the responsibility of wealth and really sang because I think of the Depression. Money comes and money goes. So it's very important to learn to get a job, and it's very important to remember that most of the world around you has much less than you do. So get involved to make a difference.
You really took this to heart. In fact, you inherited a great deal of money and then gave it all away. Is that true?
Yes, I was told at age 14 that we would be getting, I had a brother and a sister as well, and that we would each be getting $1 million and no more. But imagine being 14 years old and being told this. They did it for two reasons. One, they wanted us to be prepared, but it also came with a set of instructions. We expect you to volunteer in the community because it's the way that you will build community and build understanding. And beginning at age 14, we expect you to volunteer 5 hours a week. But they also said, beginning at age 16, we expect you to actually work for pay. So it gave me the reality that no matter how much privilege clearly I had, that I had to pay my way and that I was expected to be part of the community. Many wealthy families today do not deliver this message to their kids. And as a result, we have a lot of kids in the top 5% who are living in an environment of entitlement.
I'm curious about this, the ways in which you see philanthropy changing people's lives, because you've talked a lot about isolation, and you can understand why. You have a lot of money, everybody kowtows to you, you begin to think that you're very important. Can being a philanthropist change that?
It depends on how you do your philanthropy. So I believe in community-based philanthropy, which is really donors and activists and community leaders identifying problems in their communities and then going out and solving them together. It doesn't need to be a lonely business. You know, what I learned from going out and doing a lot of site visits, there are low-income and middle-income people that have fantastic capital. That capital is just different than mine. So I might have financial capital and influence capital, but they have creative capital, and they have a lot of knowledge. And they also have community capital at a very different level than I do. And it's when we combine that capital that the greatest changes can happen. It also changes the lives of low and middle income and unemployed people to see people, for instance, today going to the Occupy movement who are part of that 1% to say, we care. We know that the country's broken right now, and we're here in solidarity to help some of those changes happen.
Well, I understand that there is passion to be found in the site visits. How do you get those people together? Because they don't have any ordinary way to meet, do they?
Well, the great thing is that there's now a network of over 300 community-based foundations in the country. And these are meeting places where people who are looking for money that have nonprofits and donors who are looking to redistribute their money and to find out about interesting opportunities come together and get informed by the staff and go on site visits periodically or attend forum and discuss together what's needed. And that makes it much easier to be very deliberate about your giving. So does online giving. Now people can really get a very strong sense of what's in their community by doing some online research. There are all kinds of new forms of philanthropy that are out there now in which you don't have to give money away alone. And it's a preferred way of giving. I think we enjoy the collective aspect of discussing things and thinking about, is this the right way to go?
There are a lot of wealthy people, or at least I have the impression that there are a lot of wealthy people who've never really had any experience of what it's like to be without. Is it different for them?
Yes, it is. And I can give an example, a very real example that I got just last week. I got called by an attorney who said that his client were high-tech folks and they had lived a very unreal life for many, many years. And they were having trouble with their son, been having a lot of problems in his life. And when I began to talk to the family, it was clear that there was very little bond between them all, a lot of distance. And when it came down to how much they were giving him for allowance, they said beginning at age 18, he'd gotten $125,000 of annual allowance.
Wow.
Now, this is just has no reality for someone. And without tutelage or without support on how to spend that money or how to think about it, they had no one to go to ask what was real. That kind of isolation, it's a tragedy for a family because it creates a lot of problems, you know, in the kid. And on the one hand, you'd think, such a problem I'd like to have. Yeah. But I have seen in many wealthy families the level of dysfunction that sets in. Years ago, I said one of the greatest tragedies for our country will be if we allow our wealthy to become too isolated with their wealth. And that is exactly what's happened. They're disconnected from community need.
So I'm curious, with this family, did you have recommendations for them? Is there a way to encourage him to engage a little more as well as encouraging his parents to do the same?
So I'm working with the family now, and so part of what I'm doing is coaching him. And what we're trying to do is to absolutely shift the sense of isolation of that family, but also give them some projects together. So the more we can bring them into community together, it really humanizes the whole experience. Thousands of people, of course, that are in the top 1% or 5% are involved in philanthropy at a very high level. There are also hundreds of thousands that are not yet engaged, I think, who are rethinking this. And this is a moment of great hope, because I do think that issue of feeling complicit, of realizing I didn't vote my proxies, I didn't speak up about public policy, I've underpaid the people that have worked for me, I've been a person who has really not done my share for others. Those are moments of breakthrough in consciousness, and I think we're having a lot of that happening, in part because the people in Occupy Wall Street are all over the world stating that they want us to be thinking and more thoughtful.
Yeah, I'm really curious about that. As a matter of fact, I'm curious to know what your feeling is about both sides of that. There is the 1%, if it is indeed 1%, at whom fingers are being pointed, and you deal with a lot of them in the question of how generous they're willing to be. I'm curious about the 99%. Is it hard for the 99% to have any sympathy at all for the 1%?
It's my belief, actually, that the schism is in some way not as useful as everyone assuming responsibility for their part in the breakdown of the system. And what I'm finding is that people in the top 1%, first of all, don't even know they're there. So if you have $6 million or more of assets or $380,000 or more pre-tax income, then actually you're in the top 1%. And so, first of all, a lot of people that are there are saying, hey, taxation, just as you've heard from Gates and Buffett and others, you know, really taxation of the top 1% does need to happen differently, and we're prepared and ready to do that. There have been people all over the country talking about that for a long time. What I'm seeing, because I'm part of donor networks, in fact, I was just in Denver a few days ago when a group of women donors who are all in the top 3% went to Occupy Denver to bring not only donations but to sit and to listen to the General Assembly. And so there's genuine interest in listening carefully to what is needed by a small set of people. I don't want to say others. There are others that are extremely angry about this, that feel that it's not fair to point fingers at the 1%. But by and large, I think most people who have 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 houses realize, hey, we've lived like queens and kings. There were no holds on the system. We took advantage of the system because nobody held us accountable. And now people are asking us to be accountable at a different level. It's very important that we respond. And the vast majority of wealthy people will tell you that they didn't think about what would happen to the bottom 99%. They didn't feel complicit. They assumed the system would was taking care of people. It's a kind of idealism. Their 1% has been made on the back of the 99%. But, you know, I think we're now re-looking at policies and ways that can change. And that's a healthy thing for this democracy. It's a very hopeful thing.
So walk me through the process. I mean, let's pretend, and believe me, it would be a pretense, that I had $2 million I wanted to give away. How would you help me come up with a plan to get rid of it in a way that would make me feel good and do the most good?
So the first thing I would do is to ask you a big question. What is it that you'd like to change or preserve during your lifetime? So it starts with your values. And then from that place of value, that place of great passion, how can we get connected to find out what's needed? That's where the real joy and the excitement steps in. So we can have our lifetime giving and we can have our legacy giving. And what I've been doing in recent years is reminding people that actually you might feel that you can only give so much now, but you might have a future inheritance. You might sell a house. You might sell a business. You might feel compelled because you feel complicit in what is going on with this inequality right now to sell your second or third vacation house. And you might think, let's contribute that money. Let's not give 3% of it away. Let's actually give 50% of it away. So I think this is a moment where a new level of thinking is happening in philanthropy that really is about the creative aspects of how we can redistribute our wealth and our power.
I'm curious about you. You gave away your money. You've done it a couple of times. You're clearly enthusiastic about this. The question is, do you ever regret having given away that money?
There are moments when cash flow is terrible, just like for everyone else, of course. You know, I work for a nonprofit organization. I take home $60,000 a year. I give away 40% of it. The cash flow is awful at nonprofits right now. You know, I mean, I have difficulties like everyone else around living my life, and I'm very blessed. If somebody had told me that my sense of abundance as a person was going to come from giving away that money, which has meant being connected to so many people, I'm the richest person alive. I know thousands of people all over the world who care about justice. And that's the greatest gift of all. And I think my parents knew that when they said, get involved. This is about you creating community with others for a better world. What a great gift. Give me $100. I will give as much of it away as I can. Because I know in giving that away, there is a transformation in the relationship that happens between me and that other person and our sense of possibilities for the world. Absolutely. Go, baby, go. May we all do it more.
Tracy Gehry is a philanthropic advisor and the founder of Inspired Legacies. Her book is called Inspired Philanthropy. Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. It's the title of a recent book by Ralph Nader. Now, you probably know him better as a consumer advocate and frequent presidential candidate, but it turns out he's also a novelist. Though the book's fiction, Nader calls it a practical utopia, his handbook for how to save America. All it would take is a few very generous billionaires. He started off by reading the prologue.
In the cozy den of the large but modest house in Omaha, where he had lived since he started on his first billion, Warren Buffett watched the horrors of Hurricane Katrina unfold on television in early September 2005. He saw the furious winds and the avaricious waters breach the levees to cover three-quarters of the historic city of New Orleans. Deeply affected, he stayed home the next day to watch the nonstop coverage of floating corpses, people stranded on housetops crying for help with outstretched arms, chaos and collapse inside convention and sports arenas, overflowing with human despair, human kindness, and human depravity. On the fourth day, he beheld in disbelief the paralysis of local, state, and federal authorities. How could this be happening in the world's wealthiest country? Even the poorest of countries buried their dead quickly. Warren felt a wave of shame that bored through to his gut, his soul. He had to do something, personally, immediately, at least for the refugees on the roadsides. He summoned two assistants, one to drive him nonstop down to New Orleans, the other to arrange for truckloads of food, water, blankets, portable toilets, basic medicines, sturdy tents, and sleeping bags, all to be accompanied by as many public health workers as they could muster. 26 hours later, he and his convoy arrived at a scene from Goya, or Hieronymus Bosch. Warren's relief workers quickly took charge. In the midst of all the activity, Warren was supervising and helping in the distribution up and down the roadside and into the adjoining fields. Word began to spread. A mega billionaire from Nebraska had arrived with critical resources and personnel. The refugees watched in wonder as the renowned septuagenarian in jeans and rolled up sleeves moved along the road, clearly in command. Coming upon a family of a dozen or so adults and children huddled around a crude campfire, Warren reassured them. He took their hands, hugged their trembling children, and looked into their eyes. A composed elderly grandmother cupped his hands in hers and cried out, "Only the super rich can save us."
That is great. Thank you.
Okay.
You should write this kind of thing more often. So is this a fantasy of yours that Warren Buffett and a few other mega billionaires will step forward and pay for the basic services?
Yeah, well, if you read the book, you'll see it's really very realistic detail. Once you accept the assumption of 17 real-life super-rich Americans moving their resources and know-how to the side of the people and taking on the power structure, tapping into all the talent in the communities, everything else could happen.
And some of the people you mention in your book, I mean, some of your characters are Warren Buffett, Barry Diller, Ted Turner, George
That's right.
Soros, Bill Cosby.
They're all real people in fictional roles. However, I don't lobotomize them. So I lead from their background, their skill, their contacts, what they've done in an enlightened way.
So why don't you call this a novel?
Because it's not a novel because it doesn't have character development and a plot. Technically, it's called A Practical Utopia. Utopia, to most people, think is, you know, pie in the sky. This one shows how to get there.
So I guess I'm trying to figure out how to read this book. I mean, you've spent your whole life going after corporate America, criticizing them, and here you are. It sounds like you're serious about this, saying, you know, if these super rich people, some of the richest people in the country, would just step forward, they could actually solve a lot of problems in America by giving away their money.
And when you see the collision of what they built around the country with the Wall Street barons and Congress, you'd say this definitely can happen. You can stereotype 99% of the super rich as narcissistic and short-sighted, but there's always that small percentage that's got fire in their belly, good values. They've done things in their past that have been good too. So you don't need many. You don't need. I could tell Buffett, you want to have a comprehensive rehaul of the tax system, Warren? Split off $1 billion from the 32 you gave to the Gates Foundation, and I'll get it for you in 2 years.
Explain that. What should Warren Buffett do?
It's got to go through one institution, doesn't it? It's called the Congress. 535 people. All the companies opposing you don't have a single vote. So what's left is to organize a district like it's never been organized, and to each zero in on every representative and the two senators. What it needs is money and smarts, and there are a lot of smarts, but there's no money. But when you're willing to spend $15 billion, that's what this whole book turned the country around in, $15 billion. And, of course, it attracted a lot of media because, you know, whenever the super rich do stuff, they get free media.
And Ted Turner, he's one of your fictional characters,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, and Ted Turner was a big solar advocate and is very flamboyant, and he knew how to get people's attention at the solar festivals. You see, it's all about imagination, Steve. We don't imagine enough. Our expectation levels of what we can get in this country and what our government should be like are so low that they actually abort public support.
Okay, so you're saying that with $15 billion and the clout of these super rich people who are, of course, famous around the country.
And smarts.
What would change? You're saying the whole country could change. The political system would change. The economic system would change. Paint me a vision of the country, that how it would change with this $15 billion given away in a smart way.
Well, first of all, full health care for all, single payer, living wage. It would be a much stronger enforcement budget to prevent and punish corporate crime, fraud, and abuse, like ripping off Medicare, the Wall Street shenanigans, investor fraud, product defects, and many more. There would be more community economics, more democratic credit unions, more community health clinics, more farmer-to-food markets, more local energy, wind power, et cetera. That would reduce the reliance and dependency of people on faraway corporations and skyscrapers making decisions for their lives. See, as long as you have public sentiment behind you, In other words, majority of the people agree we should have clean elections and crack down on corporate crime and so on. And as long as you have the money.
Usually to become a billionaire, you have a massive ego. You have an agenda. This presupposes that these billionaires could actually agree on an agenda.
And that's what Warren Buffett provided. They had such respect for him. And he basically said, look, I picked you out of many others for what you've done, but most important, for your temperament and your perspective.
Have you talked with Warren Buffett about
that? Oh, yeah. I had breakfast with him in Omaha. He was quite pleased with the book. I also participated in an exchange at the New York Public Library with Ted Turner and Peter B. Lewis.
So what did Ted Turner and Peter Lewis think of your book and your ideas?
You know, they mused all over the place. I mean, you're right. They are real egos. And I was not their Warren Buffett. There was a lot of candid talk and about, you know, why they support things, why they don't, the lack of management skills by NGOs, and they're tired of supporting things that don't have results. And so I said to them, we'll give you a whole menu of have results. You know, take a look at the book.
So do you think your book, your ideas, have inspired any of these billionaires to give away more of their money?
Well, I think that it really was one of the factors pushing along the Buffett-Gates billionaire's pledge, you know, to give over half of their money to good works. But as Buffett told me, we have to now figure out what good works are. Moving from charity to justice, moving from soup kitchens to a society where people don't go hungry to begin with. When I signed this book, I put the following words in. To imagine is to envision. And that's the beauty of practical utopian writing. If you can't imagine, you can't envision. And if you can't envision, you go through the day taking what they give you, for better or for worse.
That's Ralph Nader talking with Steve Paulson. He spoke to us from the Public Interest Research Group offices, which he founded. His novel's called Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. You can hear the full interview on our website, ttbook.org, where you will also find a rich archive of past interviews. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Do you think it's easier to give or to receive?
It's more fun giving than it is getting, don't you think?
You'd be surprised how consistently people in Madison, Wisconsin felt that way.
Probably easier to receive, but it's more enjoyable to give.
I think it's easier to give. You're able to help other people. You show your love.
I think it's easier to give.
It just comes naturally.
I like giving gifts. Makes me happy.
Seeing on their face that they're so excited and they know how much time and effort it took to find the certain gift, that's my favorite. Giving gifts is honestly my favorite.
I don't know. I think it's just fun to buy for other people or do things for other people.
I don't like to get things.
And I just sometimes don't feel like I necessarily need gifts.
I'm probably hard to get a gift for.
I don't need anything.
Hard. It's easy to give gifts if you have a big heart, but also receiving gifts is easy if you have a lot of friends.
It's difficult to give meaningful gifts, I think, to somebody.
It's fun to put some thought into a gift and share it, and sometimes you're really surprised with what you do get. So
I would much rather give somebody something. I don't like receiving things. I don't know what to say. I always feel guilty.
It's like I don't have to worry about later on in the future, like, oh my God, she gave me or he gave me this, and I owe them something.
Definitely give. Less uncomfortable feeling with the round money?
I say give. I just say give.
I don't know. It just feels better, I guess.
Some views from a shopping mall here in Madison, Wisconsin, on whether it's easier to get or to give. Let us know what you think. Add your comments on Facebook or on our website, ttbook.org. What to sum up a parent's job in one word? It's giving. Essayist Marion Winnick says lately she's been working on teaching her youngest child to be giving, too.
When my daughter Jane started sixth grade in Baltimore City this year, she was told she'd have to complete 75 hours of service learning before graduating high school. With those 7 years closing in fast, she anxiously signed up to make macaroni and cheese casseroles for a downtown soup kitchen. They provided a recipe, and soon I found myself teaching her how to chop an onion, how to make a roux from butter and flour, how to boil pasta and use breadcrumbs for a crunchy topping. These soup kitchen people have a pretty fancy approach to mac and cheese. As I watched her complete the first humanitarian project of her little life, proudly carrying her frozen tinfoil pans into the soup kitchen, I felt grateful to the school system for nudging us in this direction. Helping Jane make casseroles these past few months has been a reminder of the rewards of hands-on community service, which, I have to admit, was not a part of my upbringing. My parents were the check-writing and fundraising sort, and we kids went door-to-door with envelopes for multiple sclerosis and lung cancer, for the Red Cross and the United Way. I remember the 23-mile Walk for Mankind in 1972, trudging through the wilds of New Jersey with my high school friends in our flannel shirts and hiking boots. But gathering money to address a distant problem is far more abstract than using your own hands to make something to fill the bellies of hungry people in your community. When I was a kid, my family wasn't active in a synagogue or church, and because our public school didn't have a requirement like Jane's, and because I was a typical spoiled suburban brat, I didn't get much service learning until I had kids of my own. That turned out to be a crash course. For those of us with children, life falls cleanly into two parts, before and after. In part one, your life is about you. In part two, your life is about them. Everyone enjoys heaping criticism on the breeders, your helicopter or your absentee, you do too much or not enough. For most parents, the reality is 10,000 tiny tasks, from changing diapers to driving carpools to filling out FAFSA forms. And if you don't know what that is, just be glad. Parenthood is exhausting. It is largely invisible and unappreciated, and it is relentless. It is not drinks at the bar, a day at the spa, or even a half hour on the couch. No, in fact, the next scheduled feeding is never more than a couple hours away. What will it be, kids? Macaroni and cheese? Or, hey, what about macaroni and cheese? Whether your mac and cheese is the three boxes for a dollar kind or is made from scratch with whole wheat elbows and Vermont cheddar, whether it comes in a styrofoam cup from the fried chicken chain or with chunks of lobster from the trendy cafe, dinner is on you. And so is lunch and breakfast. And thus it will continue for at least 18 years. Parenting is certainly a special flavor of community service. Rather than being above and beyond the call of duty, it is the call of duty. Only on Mother's Day and Father's Day is there any hoopla for the harried volunteers. Most of the time, we're left to stew in our sweet and sour soup of resentment and pride, and to get back to work. That's as it should be, really. As much hard work as parental giving may be, it is not altruistic. To some extent, our children are part of ourselves, intrinsic to our self-worth and our public image. Which is why when we finally send them off into the world, we are not just relieved, but bereft. We're also concerned. Will they make it out there? Can they even take care of themselves, much less be of use to others? Jane has two older brothers, one a commodities trader in Baltimore, the other a musician in New Orleans. There was no service learning back when they were in school in rural Pennsylvania, and I did little to fill the gap. Luckily, evolution has its own service learning requirement. When they become parents, they will surely learn to serve. And my crunchy breadcrumb topping for macaroni will suddenly be of much greater interest. Feeding their hungry kids will change their relationship to other people's children and to the world. In nurturing and protecting our families, we have the potential to become nurturers and protectors on a larger scale. Parenting is an individual hookup to the forces of tenderness and generosity in the world, to a caring that flies beyond self-interest, circumstance, and boundaries between people. So whether you are making macaroni for your kids, or teaching kids to make macaroni, or answering desperate phone calls from young adults who have set their ovens on fire, let me say one thing you may not have heard lately. Thank you.
Essayist and parent, Marion Winnick. Some days, it seems like everyone just wants more. But what if you're a giver? What if you want to give open-heartedly, selflessly, to give a true gift? Social anthropologist David Graeber says that might not be possible. Steve Paulson spoke with him.
Why is the culture of gift-giving so complicated?
Well, because we define gift so broadly. A gift is simply anything that you give to someone where you're not demanding anything in return. It doesn't mean you're not even expecting something, but there's no explicit contractual demand that you'll get something back. If someone asks you for a cigarette or a light, for that matter, or if you present tribute to a feudal lord or, you know, something to impress a superior in our own culture, those are completely different things, but we just lump them together as gifts.
There has been a rich anthropological tradition of studying gift giving, and I know one of the pioneers in this investigation was Marcel Mauss, who wondered whether there really ever is such a thing as a true gift, a gift given with no self-interest whatsoever. Is there any evidence that a true gift is possible?
Well, sure. I mean, it all depends on how you define it. If someone is begging on the street and you give them some money, you can create a story whereby you're getting something out of it. But really, you don't expect anything in return. What Mauss was really getting at is not so much that there is no such thing as a free gift, but the very idea that there could be such a thing as a free gift seems to be this kind of strange mirror of the market. Because if you don't have a system where you say, all right, we have this place where everybody's simply trying to get as much stuff as possible for themselves and not thinking about anyone else, then it's almost impossible to imagine the opposite. And in fact, historically, that's exactly what you get. Where you get the invention of coinage and markets, you get the invention of world religions at exactly the same times and places where people start talking about charity and free gifts. But you can't have one without the other.
So the whole culture of gift-giving changes totally once money enters into the picture?
I think that's what Mauss was really trying to get at. The question isn't, can you give a pure gift? The question is, why would we even imagine that it would be either possible or desirable to do so? One of the classic examples from a Danish writer named Peter Freuchen, who lived amongst Inuit in Greenland for a while. People there had this terrible aversion to saying thank you. You know, we'd go on a hunt, he wouldn't get anything, someone else would. Guy would show up with a ton of walrus meat or some present like that. And he said, oh, thank you so much. And he said, don't say that. You know, if you're saying thank you, it's like, you know, you're saying you owe me something. And that's wrong because we're humans. And humans, well, we help each other out. We say here, gifts make slaves like whips make dogs. So if you say thank you, you're saying it's a gift and I owe you, so that's bad. What we do is we share. If you live in a society where you don't have impersonal markets, that's what you find. You know, you give somebody something, but you might be doing it to help them. You might be doing it to get them in your debt in some way. You might be doing it because you hate them and you want to humiliate them by being more generous and showing up that they need the help. There's a million different motives, and you can't boil it down to, you know, simple greed or simple selflessness.
So there are social norms as to how a gift is to be given, and those vary from culture to culture. And I suppose we have to distinguish between those cultures where currency is used and those, well, very few cultures these days where there is no currency, but maybe we have to look back historically at this.
Yes. It's not so much that there's completely different mindsets in different cultures. Actually, everything exists simultaneously. Communism isn't some imaginary society, or communism is just one way of people interacting in all societies. The same can be said of exchange. The same can be said of patronage. All these different ways of giving gifts or making exchanges always exist. So the question is how they come together, which are favored, and most of all, which we fix on when we try to imagine what people are really like.
Well, and I'm trying to get at why this whole culture of gift-giving changes so dramatically once money enters the picture. And I mean, I suppose part of it is that now it's possible to make an exchange strictly on the basis of financial considerations. I mean, somehow are you moving the human interaction out of the picture? But then to some degree, you never are, I suppose.
Precisely. That's what Mose was really getting at. He's saying the real difference between gifts is not that one is calculating and gifts are disinterested. That's just the way it looks from the perspective of someone used to market exchange. There's other extremes where gifts are a way of humiliating someone. They actually are intentionally trying to turn people into slaves. Classic example here is the potlatch, where Native American chiefs, people who acceded to major noble titles, would throw these giant feasts where they just shower their enemies with presents while mocking them. People would receive them, take them home, and then throw another party and sort of mock their enemies, including the guy who had just given them the gift. So gifts were literally a way of belittling others.
So what comes with a gift is an obligation that you are to give something in return.
An obligation that you'll give someone something in return, or recognition that you're inferior. So very often, it's quite intense, the feelings that can be raised by someone giving a gift that cannot be paid back. Another story I like to tell, well, there's two. One's actually from Mose. He found it in a Greek author named Posidonius about Celtic nobles. They would have these contests and they'd duel and they'd try to outdo each other in games of various sorts. But one of the games was to try to give each other gifts of various glorious types that the other couldn't repay. And if you get into a situation of complete checkmate, someone gives you something so great that you couldn't possibly ever answer their gift, the only really honorable thing to do would be to commit suicide, and then your wealth is distributed to your flunkies.
Now, is that just a sort of a literary example, or is there some reality behind that story?
Who knows? I imagine it might have happened once or twice. But here's the other side of the same thing. In one of the Icelandic sagas, there's this wonderful story about these two Vikings named Einar and Egil, and they like to write poems together. One day, Egil shows up with a beautiful shield that he's gotten on a raid. It's something no one's ever seen before. His friend isn't there, so he leaves it as a present, rides off. The guy shows up about 12 hours later and sees this shield hanging there and says, "My God, what's this?" And they says, "Oh, yeah, your friend Egil left it for you. It's a present." And he takes one look at it and says, "Aha. So this guy thinks that I'm going to spend all night writing a poem celebrating his generosity. The hell of it, I'll kill him." So he gets on the horse, rides off, tries to catch up with him, but fortunately the guy has a lead. So at the end of the day, he gives up, goes home, and writes a poem about how great a guy that Einar is.
So implicit within this is there's the one-upsmanship of gift-giving, and we've probably experienced that at one point or another in our own lives.
Right. You feel that somehow you're less of a person if you can't respond with something at least as good and probably just a little bit better. And this is one of the things that Mose was fascinated with because, as he pointed out, it's not something that only occurs in the ancient world. It affects all of us. Even though our theories about how the world works tells us it shouldn't really be true. So if you take a free market economist out to dinner, he's going to feel that he really has to do the same to you, even though his theory says he should think, well, gee, I got something for nothing. Great. Why do you have that feeling?
But those expectations seem to vary so much from culture to culture. Is there something freeing about this? You know, let's do away with kind of this elaborate system of social obligations. You know, let's just make this a financial transaction.
Well, it can be. I mean, anyone who grows up in a traditional society knows that it's a little oppressive to constantly have to think about what your neighbors think of you. On the other hand, there's the upside, which is that you'll always have food. The problem with market relations is that there's winners and losers, and the losers can be in very bad shape. So that in most what they call gift economies, a phrase that Marcel Mauss invented, there's a kind of bottom line where it's not even a question of exchange. Some things you just share. We need to recognize that that's always the case. The basis of human sociality, if you're not an enemy, on a certain level, everybody's going to be a communist with one another. And the sense of, you know, if the need is great enough, like I'm drowning, or if the cost is small enough, like do you have a light? Well, it's expected that if you have a need and they have an ability, they'll help you out. What we've done is we've driven that baseline sociability to an incredibly minimal level. So I think that one thing we can learn from gift economies, we need to ratchet that up a little bit.
Now, you have been involved quite recently with the Occupy Wall Street movement, and I know you've participated in other direct actions against various global economic forums. Does this question of gift giving play a role in this whole issue as we see the problems with the global monetary and economic system?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's significant. I've written about this, that one of the first things that people do in pretty much any occupation, you know, first they establish a place to sleep, but the next thing they do is they create a library. Could we start from the idea of the library and come up with a totally different model of how goods and services could circulate? And I think people are playing around with that. I know there's working groups in New York trying to imagine a new alternative form of currency which would be inspired by the idea of the gift.
That was anthropologist David Graeber talking with Steve Paulson. His latest book is called Debt, The First 5,000 Years. What are the giving traditions in your community? Let us know on Facebook or on our website, ttbook.org. Coming up, learning to accept gifts.
It's very hard not to constantly feel beholden, and I still haven't figured out how to negotiate that.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It can be awkward to receive gifts, especially if they're gifts you don't really want. The same goes for help. But what if people thought you needed help with everything all the time? What if complete strangers insisted on giving you a hand, whether you wanted it or not? Hadar Copley Woods has had to deal with that for years, since she was diagnosed with MS. Anne Strangechamps talked with her about the challenging task of learning how to refuse and ask for help.
I have a pretty wildly fluctuating condition that causes me to, well, sometimes I walk around with no aid, sometimes I need crutches, and sometimes I need a wheelchair.
I mean, how does it affect you from day to day?
Well, it's definitely real and present in my life. It's been slowly increasingly real and present in my life for about the past 4 years, so I'm relatively new to it. It affects me in that I am most of the time seen as a disabled person by everyone around me.
Did you notice any changes in the way people interact with you when you first started using the crutches and the wheelchair?
Oh, yes. Yes. That is where the unwanted help began.
What do you mean by unwanted help?
Well, if you were to see someone easily and fluidly opening a door and walking through it, you would probably not suddenly panic and say, I'll get that, run over, fling the door open, and then stand in their way. But if the person was in a wheelchair, you just might. You might find yourself doing that. And that's the sort of unwanted help I mean, either panicking and obstructing a disabled person who's trying to just go through their day, or opening a door perfectly helpfully when the person was capable of doing it themselves. There's so much of being disabled that genuinely makes me feel helpless, that it's very important to me to be able to do the things that I can do. Very often when I'm in the chair, I will have people run over and push the elevator button for me. But sitting in a wheelchair doesn't actually affect your ability to push an elevator button.
So it's people offering to help and thereby patronizing you that you find actually more irritating than people, say, ignoring you or avoiding you?
You know, there's so much about being disabled that involves society's assumptions that you are helpless and that you need to be an object of charity. I've actually had people come up behind me and grab the back of my chair and start pushing without saying a word, which is really shocking and upsetting. Imagine if you were walking upstairs and someone just thought you needed a boost. Pretty much most people who approach me, assuming that what defines me is what I cannot do, that's emotionally exhausting.
So what do you do when people make these unwanted offers of help?
It depends on the day, and it depends on the person. There have been several times that people, perhaps elderly people, society treats them as if they are helpless. When one of them wants to open a door for me, I am very often extremely gracious because I know they finally are getting the chance to open a door for someone else. Most of the time, I'm not the kind of crip who's going to lecture a stranger. Most of the time, I grit my teeth and I try to be pleasant.
You don't think that people are sometimes simply trying to be kind and just are being very awkward about it?
You saying that reminds me of a time that I remember with keen regret when I was able-bodied, and I knew myself enough at the time to know that if I were to become disabled, I would really resent strangers constantly helping me when I didn't need it. And I was driving down the street. I still remember exactly what street it was. And there was a man in a manual wheelchair struggling against what had been a very sudden snowstorm. And I saw him and I thought, I don't want to insult him by offering help. And I kept driving. And I wish I could go back to that moment and at least pull over and offer to help.
I wonder, how much are these questions talked about in the disability community? I mean, did anybody ever give you advice about how to respond when a stranger grabs your chair?
This is almost constantly discussed. A lot of times we'll just sort of share these stories because sometimes it's hard for someone who isn't disabled to understand how angering an interaction like that can be. And so we'll tell each other and then we'll sort of laugh. And sometimes we will ask for advice. And it's very hard based on your personality, based on what region you live in, based on how accessible your town is. It seems like there's a different way to deal with it. Minneapolis is an incredibly accessible town, except for the snow. If you live in some older towns or in towns that do not enforce the ADA quite as well, you might need a lot more help from strangers, maybe to get over curbs and things like that.
Are there ways in which people can offer to help that do work for you?
I think that it's very individual. In my mind, if at all possible, imagining that a person with a disability does not have a disability and just watching for struggle and offering to help seems to make most sense. There have been times when I have definitely needed help if I'm in my wheelchair or in one of those scooters at the drugstore or something, and I need something on a top shelf. There is something that I think binds us together when I ask a person who's just walking along, would you lend me a hand? Would you mind getting down that aspirin for me from the shelf? And they say, sure, and they get it down. And I feel good that someone cared enough to help me when it wasn't their job, and they feel good that they could connect to another person in this way. And I think that is a wonderful way of connecting and of helping each other. When you are genuinely helping people with what they really need, it's part of what makes us human. It's part of how we became human.
It sounds to me like you're somebody who really values your independence. Has it been a challenge to learn how to ask?
Yes, and that's, I think it's really important to almost every American that I know, being independent. For me in particular, I'm an extremely, extremely physical person, and I still am. I still work out probably more than most. I know that my physicality is part of what attracted my spouse, and especially when I first became disabled, that was difficult, not because my husband liked me any less, but because I was afraid that it would change who I was in a really fundamental way. It turns out that it didn't, but I do need to ask for help, and having only been disabled for 4 years, my house is still set up for an able-bodied person. So if I'm having a bad night and I need to be in the wheelchair, I need to ask for help to get almost everything down. Just in basic things like if I want a drink of water, I need to ask my spouse to get me down a glass. And I don't like that. I don't like that at all. And it makes me feel like less of an adult. Even though it's necessary, I really need that drink of water. And then there are times when I'm hit so badly that I need him to help me drag me up the stairs, frankly, so I can get to bed. And asking for that help and then receiving that help from someone with whom you have a sexual relationship, really, that takes some negotiating.
What does he say?
Jan is kind of an amazing person. He is always willing to help. We've had a few moments where I became angry that he didn't anticipate something that I would need. I always need my wheelchair in museums, for instance, and he very kindly loaded the wheelchair into the car for me. And when we got there, I saw that he had not checked the tires, and you really need to fill them every time. And he hadn't done that. And I yelled at him, oh, this is so embarrassing to remember. I was just so angry that he hadn't anticipated that need for me. So I've started kind of taking for granted that he's just going to assume certain things. So we're still kind of negotiating those sorts of things.
Is part of the difficulty for you in being able to ask for help that it feels humiliating?
Yes, it definitely does. I mean, MS is a progressive disease. I'm assuming that I'm going to be needing more and more help, and I hope that we'll be in a financial situation where I can actually hire people to do some of the really, really personal, intimate things that I would just prefer that my spouse didn't do. I feel like having a barrier between those two things will help me to feel as if we're in a more equal relationship, but we might not be able to afford it. He might need to be doing a lot of very intimate, you know, bathing, bathroom kind of things for me as we get older. I'm very nervous about that. I think that when you're in an ongoing relationship with someone, when one person is doing almost all of the helping, it's very hard not to constantly feel beholden. And I still haven't figured out how to negotiate that. And that's a very uncomfortable place to be in.
Sounds like it's a question of grace. How to accept a gift or help with grace.
Yes, I mean, it's very similar to being able to accept a compliment. I've learned how to do that, and so I'm confident that I will learn how to negotiate this with Jan, but so far I'm still working on it.
Hadar Copley Woods has been living with MS since 2007. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you'll also find a link to the weekly podcast. If you want to keep an eye on what's on our minds, follow us on Facebook. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Giving It Away, program number 1127B. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Sarah Nix, with the help of Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, and Anne Strainchamps. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.